This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Art Spiegelman, creates comic books for adults on themes that are usually tackled by serious fiction. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his comic book, Mouse, which told two complex stories, how his father survived the Holocaust and what it was like for Spiegelman to be the son of a troubled, paranoid survivor. Art Spiegelman also founded Raw Magazine, which showcased the work of avant-garde comic book and graphic artists. In the past couple of years, he's done several cover illustrations for The New Yorker magazine. Now he's illustrated a book-length poem from 1928 called The Wild Party, which Spiegelman describes as a lost classic, a hard-boiled jazz-age tragedy told in syncopated rhyming couplets. His illustrations are inspired by pulp fiction, German expressionism, and comic books. William Burroughs says The Wild Party is the poem that made him want to be a writer. I asked Spiegelman to read the opening of this poem, written by Joseph Moncure March.
Queenie was a blonde, and her age stood still, and she danced twice a day in vaudeville. Gray eyes, lips like coals aglow, her face was a tinted mask of snow. What hips, what shoulders, what a back she had. Her legs were built to drive men mad, and she did. She would skid, but sooner or later they bored her. 16 a year was her order. They might be blackguards, they might be curs, they might be actors, sports, chauffeurs. She never inquired of the men she desired about their social status or wealth. She was only concerned about their health. True, she knew. There was little she hadn't been through. And she liked her lovers violent and vicious. Queenie was sexually ambitious. So, now you know. A fascinating woman as they go. She lived at present with a man named Burrs whose act came on just after hers. A clown of renown. Three-sheeted all over town. He was comical as sin, comical as hell. A gesture, a grin, and the house would yell, uproarious. He was glorious. So from the front. People in the wings saw him and thought of other things coldly, most coldly. Many would say them boldly, adding in language without much lace, they'd like to break his goddamn face. Ask why? They might be stuck. They'd like to, just for luck. But these were men for the greater part. A woman would offer him up her heart, throbbing, on a platter. He could bite it, and it wouldn't matter. As long as he kissed and held her tight and gave her a fairly hectic night, which he could and would, a man these women understood. Oh, yes, Burrs was a charming fellow, brutal with women and proportionately yellow. Once he had been forced into a marriage. Unlucky girl, she had a miscarriage 2 days later. Possibly due to the fact that Burrs beat her with the heel of a shoe till her lips went blue. For a week, her brother had great fun looking for Burrs with a snub-nosed gun, at the end of which time she began to recover. And Burrs, having vanished, the thing blew over. Just a sample, for example. One is probably ample.
How did you first discover the poem?
Well, it was part of rummaging around used bookstores, which has always been my version of tranquilizers, just whenever things are going too weird and crazy, I spend a day in a bookstore. And what made this unusual is I usually have better fare to hunt through than the poetry sections. It's not where I usually find what I'm interested in. And this, because it had a very nicely designed spine typography, made me pull it out, open it up, and find a frontispiece by Reginald Marsh. And he's an artist I've always enjoyed and admired, even though he's not in great modernist repute. And opened the poem, started reading it, and found myself reading it all the way through and saying, oh, this is poetry I can deal with. I like this. And then just figured someday I'd like to draw it. And the someday finally came about 20 years later.
Now let's look at one of the illustrations from the passage that we just heard. There's a part that describes how she had a miscarriage because her boyfriend beat her with the heel of a shoe till her lips went blue. And describe the picture that you've come up with for that.
Okay, well, let's see. Seen across the bottom part of spread of the two pages, there's a three-quarter rear view of Burrs with a heel of a shoe in his, with a shoe in his hand, ready to strike. A young woman in a brief nightgown is protecting her face while she's lying on a bed. And superimposed on the picture is a clipping from an old Sears Roebuck catalog of shoes from the period, showing that you can get either the spike heel or the Cuban style heel for the shoe.
Yeah, this is an ad for lustrous black patent leather pumps. Choice of Cuban or spike heel. Why did you put that little ad in?
Oh, partially to acknowledge my sources, because I was doing a lot of steeping myself in the period in order to get the details right, and partially just to pull some distance away from what would otherwise be a brutalizing action.
You write in your introduction that you confess to a powerful nostalgia for all decades that precede your birth. What do you think that is?
Oh, I'm sure it's a yearning for an innocence that never was.
Well, you're not going to find innocence in hard-boiled stuff or in German Expressionism.
Oh, I guess, although I find that this book has a kind of curdled innocence, I guess is the phrase that keeps coming to my mind. That the message, insofar as there is a moral or a message in this book, probably is one can't afford to be innocent. And yet there is a kind of pleasurable, wide-open eagerness for the decadent thrills that are coming through in this book.
Tell us something about the author Joseph Moncure March.
Well, it turns out he was the first Jesus at the New Yorker, the Jesus being the managing editor who was meant to save the place from chaos. And he lasted about a year, but he brought in, among other people, I think E.B. White indirectly into the magazine. And he was he'd gone to prep school with Reginald Marsh, incidentally, which is how he got to get Marsh to do the illustrations. They were seated alphabetically next to each other. And lived in New York, wanted to be a writer. He was more or less being supported by his father, who was a businessman, and was willing to support him as long as he could prove he really was a writer. So in the summer of 1926, he took time out from his wild parties to make this book.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Art Spiegelman. In his graphic novel, Mouse, won a Pulitzer Prize. His new book is called The Wild Party. It's his illustrations for a poem that was written in 1928 by Joseph Moncure March. What was it like for you when Mouse ended? You'd worked on that for years, and it came out in installments in your magazine, Raw. And then there were, what, two books worth of Mouse that came out?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was one book separated before birth, but the first part came out in 86 and the second part in 92.
Okay, and then it was over. You finished it after years and years of work. What did you turn to after that? And what did it feel like when it was finished?
Well, on the one hand, I felt thoroughly confused by the success and acclaim the book had had, and rather scared of the demands that were beginning to be made on me, demands to become a spokesperson for the second generation
of Holocaust survivors,
and to become an ongoing, Eli Wiesel of the comic book or something. and that terrified me. I didn't want to be a spokesperson for anything. And there were essentially the questions that would come my way would be, so when is Mouse 3 coming out? As if this was an endless story, like Blondie and Dagwood, with Dagwood still running after his bus 50 years later. And it was necessary for me just to keep sane, to be able to find other territory that was pleasurable for me to explore. And I think that's why The Wild Party came back into my head. I mean, here was a book with no cats, no mice, virtually no Jews, politically incorrect, no saving graces except the pleasures of the rhythms of the poem, a chance to do something that was decorative rather than as austere as Mao's had to be in order to not create a lapse in judgment and taste. And in some ways, it was chosen primarily as a not-mouse.
Well, let me add something to that in the not-mouse category. There were no members of your family in the book. This was not a book that was personal about your relationship with your father.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to kind of go out and deal with sex and death in forums outside the family drama.
Now, what was it like for you to go after so many years of working in the underground, you know, of having this devoted but really small audience, to winning a Pulitzer Prize, getting reviewed all over, and being acclaimed?
Well, it still unhinges me a bit. I know there are all these people from movie studios who keep contacting me wanting to make a movie out of Mouse. That still goes on now. And this producer calls up and says, we want to bring your work to a wide audience. And I think of like 300,000 or 400,000 people as a rather good-sized audience, actually. And he thinks of it as a cult book as he's talking to me from his Hollywood office.
Would you be interested in making a movie out of Mouse?
Not at all. No, I can't. I mean, when I was asked to do this, usually I don't have to have this conversation. It's my agent who fends this off for me. But somebody found their way through to me from creative artist, and said, you don't understand, we'll give you complete creative control. And I said, I wouldn't know what to do with it. I just don't know how it should be made into a movie. Last time I thought about this, I thought we should use real mice.
And what, you train them?
I was interested in having these like screen tests with mice talking, you know, but when I told him to get back to me when he could arrange it.
What happened to Raw Magazine?
It's on ice, basically, because in some ways, the things that became possible for me after Mouse, including, hey, I want to illustrate The Wild Party, and the publisher says, sure, that sounds good. What's The Wild Party? Opened up other things that I wanted to do and took time away. For another thing, a number of the cartoonists who were part of that generation of Raw artists have found their way into other venues, so it became less urgent to do a magazine to present their work. So that at this point, Charles Burns's work, a fellow Philadelphian of yours, appears on the cover of Time magazine, and he has plenty of publishers interested in doing his comics. Same thing is true for Gary Panter, who did the sets for the Pee Wee Herman show. Same thing is true for Sue Coe, whose work is appearing all around town, and so on. And the comic scene isn't quite as bleak as it was in 1980 when we started Raw. So that's one side of it. And the other side of it, I suppose, is that The New Yorker came along and offered an opportunity for the other half of Raw, Françoise Mouly, my wife, to be the art editor, and has given me and a number of other Raw artists pages to work on there.
My guest is comic book artist Art Spiegelman. In his new book, The Wild Party, he illustrates a 1928 hard-boiled poem. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with comic book artist Art Spiegelman. You had a cover in The New Yorker on Valentine's Day of 93.
Yes.
And this was a very controversial cover. It was a male Hasidic Jew embracing and kissing with an African-American woman.
Mm-hmm.
And this was during the period of a lot of friction, not that friction has stopped, but of a lot of friction in New York City between blacks and Hasidic Jews.
Yeah, it was in the wake of Crown Heights.
Yeah. And you got some pretty hostile reaction to that cover.
I sure did. Well, for instance, in the New York Times, there's an op-ed page piece describing, with horror, this cover and describing the Jews' lascivious lips. And then in the Washington Post, there was another op-ed piece that described the Jews' prim lips. And that gave me a clue as to the objection to this image. It had to do with the fact that Jews might have lips, because I couldn't draw lips that were simultaneously prim and lascivious otherwise. And then I found that there was, some spokesperson for the black community was complaining that I had drawn a black woman one more time being oppressed by white men. And why hadn't I drawn a black man kissing a white woman? To which I pointed out to this reverend that he might be a good reverend, but he was a rotten art director. It's much harder to show a Hasidic woman in an instant than a Hasidic man. And that in any case, the stereotypes run deep. All I would have really accomplished is a stereotype of the black, rapacious, sexual male rapist. So that the stereotypes were the problem. The imagery underlying the racial problem were the problem, not the cover. But I was, I did it feeling I'd conjured up a messianic image of peace, if anything, and knew that it was more appropriate for April Fool's Day than Valentine's Day when I presented it, and ultimately was kind of gratified by the response, because if it got the black community and the Hasidic community angry at me, at least they had a common enemy now.
You have a recent cover in The New Yorker from September 26, 1994. And the cover illustration is of a rather prim-looking middle-aged woman who's waiting for a bus. And there's one of those really large posters at the bus stop, and the poster is for men's underwear. And so there's this really large male bikini-clad crotch in this underwear ad that she's both looking at and trying to avoid at the same time.
Right, it's a bus shelter, but it's not very sheltering somehow.
Yeah, but she looks very embarrassed by the whole thing. And so the advertisement reads Briefs, and you've titled the cartoon Brief Encounter.
Right.
So what made you think about doing this cover of a
Well, let's see. Part of it is that I rarely go out of the house. And then I did one day and it ended up in Times Square.
Uh-huh.
And then looming over Times Square is an 8-story high Calvin Klein's male crotch, Blade Runner-like, hovering over the city. And I found it really oppressive. So I went home, identified thoroughly with this Helen Hokuson-like middle-aged woman and came up with this image. Much to my surprise, everything that comes around goes around. So a month later, I did a cover for the New Yorker's fashion issue, which was a drawing of a fashion runway and a model in, I don't remember the designer's name, Blahnik shoes, walking down the runway as a bunch of naked reporters and paparazzi photographers sit in the audience. And that cover got turned into an 8-story high Sony billboard right next to the Calvin Klein poster to oppress other people and inspire yet more covers in the future by somebody else, I suppose.
How odd. Now, you said you rarely go out of your apartment.
That's still true, yeah.
Well, why?
It's dangerous out there. I don't know. I mean, cartooning, drawing, writing, it's very labor-intensive, quiet activity, so I find it just takes up most of my day. And I do go out for cigarettes, and I now work in a studio 3 blocks from the house. So I do have those 3 blocks, and I did get mugged once walking those 3 blocks, but for the most part, it's a fairly safe 3 blocks, and I stay there.
What happened to you when you got mugged?
Actually, it was just, let's see, what happened? So I'm walking home, it's a very quiet 3 blocks, 8 o'clock at night, and I'd learned my street smarts, a generation earlier. There were three, rather unsavory-looking young black men sitting on a stoop, and I had to figure out what to do. I could no longer turn around and run, I felt. And I figured I should just walk past and keep my eyes straight ahead, which was the way one would do it in 1970, when I did go out of the house. And it seems that now that's no longer a good idea, because this was, as the cop told me later, a way of them perceiving that I was dissing them by not feeling threatened, where obviously they were threatening. So I was supposed to cross over warily and continue walking, they said. So I didn't. Walked by, and then one person goes, "Yo, what are you looking at?" And then whacks me on the back of the head with a board. And that knocks my glasses off, which I'd forgotten to remove from when I was writing and drawing. And instead of running or walking away, I start looking for my glasses, which got him really angry at me. And he picked up a Coke bottle, at which point I figured it was time to go away and get my glasses later. So it wasn't even a mugging that led to permanent damage other than a bump on my head or to money being taken or anything like that. It was just sort of something to remind me that that these are dangerous times.
Now, because you're so, I'm interested in this because you're so interested in crime fiction and in illustrations from crime fiction. So did any images stick with you? Of course, you probably couldn't even see without your glasses.
No, I could, because they're just for reading. No, mainly what I saw was stars, so I drew some. You know, like that's
did you really see stars?
Yeah, it was a good solid whack to the back of the head. So I got, I mean, I think in cartoon imagery, I suppose, so that maybe I wouldn't have seen stars unless I'd already been primed that that's what you see after you get whacked on the head. But there they were.
What are some of the other things that you think you experience as comic book images?
Oh, let's see. When somebody's mumbling and talking really softly, I see a speech balloon above their head with letters that I can barely read. that's one. And when seeing some member of my family close up, little kind of hearts might appear, you know. It's animated cartoon images as well. And primarily, I suppose, it's when I think back on events, you know, that I think of them in terms of panel one, panel two, and I get to edit out the uninteresting stuff that would happen in between.
Art Spiegelman, his new book, The Wild Party, brings together a 1928 poem by Joseph Moncure March with Spiegelman's illustrations.